ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय We're reading, well, we'll chant. I think I'm going to go a little further ahead, but we'll recite text 8, canto 9, chapter 1, starting the canto. Parapareshaṁ bhūtānāṁ Atmaya purushak paraha Sa eva sid idam vishvam Kalpante nyad nakinchana Paravaresham bhutanam Atma yat purushat paraha Sa eva sid idam vishvam Kalpante nyad nakinchana Para avaresham of all living entities in higher or lower statuses of life. Bhutanam of those who have taken material bodies, the conditioned souls. Atma, the super soul. Yaha, one who is. Purushaha, the supreme person. Paraha, transcendental. Saha, he. Eva, indeed. Asit, was existing. Idam, this. Vishvam, universe. Kalpa ante, at the end of the millennium. Anyat, anything else. Na, not. Kinchana, anything whatsoever. So, I'm gonna go, not read the purport, the verse and purport right now, it's a really short purport. I'm gonna go back to the beginning, the chapter summary, and then we'll read forward, including this one. Get ready for a lot of surprising information. King Sadyumna becomes a woman. This chapter describes how Sudyumna becomes a woman and how the dynasty of Vaivasvata Manu was amalgamated with the Soma Vangsha, the dynasty coming from the moon. Before I go further, this ninth canto is dealing with lineages of kings within the Sun Dynasty and Moon Dynasty. Krishna appears in the Moon Dynasty, and when he gets to Krishna at the end of the canto, it becomes the tenth canto. It's all about Krishna. But it starts with the Sun Dynasty. So the Sun Dynasty is Vivaswan and Vaivasvatamanu, and the dynasty from Vaivasvatamanu, of which Lord Ramachandra, or in which Lord Ramachandra appears within the Sun Dynasty. Oh, you'll hear, at least in the lineage of Ramchandra, the name in this summary, Ikshvaku. And Ikshvaku is in that Sun Dynasty as Ramchandra is in the Sun Dynasty. So just mentioned here, I'll point it out again as we go in this chapter summary, how that connection between the Sun Dynasty and the Moon Dynasty takes place. Here we go. By the desire of Maharaj Parikshit, Shukadeva Goswami told about the dynasty of Vaivasvata Manu, who was formerly King Satyavrata, the ruler of Dravida. I'll stop again. The previous canto ends with Satyavrata becomes, in his next life, Vaivasvata Manu, the son of Vivaswan. And in case you get a little confused, he has two names, at least. Vaivasvata Manu has another name that we'll hear, Shraddhadeva. Shraddhadeva was his name, and his post was Vaivasvata Manu. They both mean the same. Two names, one person. Say it again. Shraddhadeva and Vaivasvata Manu, they're the same person. Vaivasvata Manu refers to the post, and so that means during different cycles of yugas, Vaivasvata Manu may have different names, but he's Vaivasvata Manu. This one is being narrated as Shraddhadeva. And then also mentioned is the word Dravida, just like, you know, Dravida Prabhu, he comes and visits here almost once a year. So the word Dravida appears in the Bhagavatam several places, and it refers to sections of India in the south. Dravida Desha. Desha means tract of land. Dravida Desha is the southern part of India. And King Satyavrata resided and ruled in the south of India. Or Dravida. That's the reference here. So while describing the dynasty of Vaivasvata Manu, Shukadeva Goswami also described how the Supreme Personality of Godhead, while lying down in the waters of devastation, gave birth to Lord Brahma from a lotus generated from his navel, from the mind of Lord Brahma. Marichi was generated, and his son was Kashyapa. So now we're getting descendants. Vishnu, Brahma, and of course many sons, but Kashyapa from his the mind of Brahma, and Kashyapa's son, Marichi was born, and his son was Kashyapa. There we go. Kashyapa, the son of Marichi. From Kashyapa, through Aditi, this is described in Canto 6, all of what we're hearing now, and now it's being repeated again in Canto 9. From Kashyapa, through Aditi, Vivaswan was generated, and from Vivaswan came Shraddhadeva. Shraddhadeva is Vaivasvata Manu, who was born from the womb of Sangya. Sangya was one of the wives of Vivaswan, Sangya. We'll hear some more. Sangya, Shraddhadeva's wife, Shraddha, gave birth to 10 sons, such as Ikshvaku and Nriga. So in later chapters, we're going to hear more about these personalities. But now it's just, laying the foundation. Paragraph. Shraddhadeva or Vaivasvata Manu, the father of Maharaj Ikshvaku, before Ikshvaku was born, he was sonless. Before Ikshvaku's birth. But by the grace of the great sage Vashishta, he performed the yajna to satisfy Mitra and Varuna. These are demigods. Varuna is a demigod. Mitra is a demigod. Vashishta performed the yajna on behalf of the king, Vaivasvata Manu. Then, although Vaivasvata Manu wanted a son, by the desire of his wife, he got a daughter named Ila. Manu, however, was not satisfied with the daughter. Consequently, for Manu's satisfaction, the great sage Vashishta prayed for Ila to become transferred into a boy. No surgical operation. Just prayer. And his prayer was fulfilled by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Thus, Elah, born as a girl, became a beautiful young man named Sudyumna. Paragraph. And then, once upon a time, Sudyumna went on tour with his ministers. At the foot of the mountain Sumeru, there was a great forest named Sukumara, and as soon as they entered that forest, they were all transformed into women. He's like two different genders, and a third one's coming up. Born as a woman or girl, transformed into a boy, walks to this forest named Sukumara, and he and his ministers all became women. Whoa. When Maharaj Pariksit inquired from Shukadeva Goswami about the reason for this transformation, Shukadeva Goswami described how Sudyumna, being transferred into a woman, accepted a husband, Buddha, son of the moon, as her husband and had a son, Pururava. So this is the connection between the Sun dynasty. This is Elah, born a girl, becomes a man, becomes a woman again. From the Sun dynasty, Elah, woman, marries Buddha, spelled differently than Lord Buddha. Buddha, so it's not the same. And the combination of the Sun dynasty, Moon dynasty, Pururava becomes the king. Excuse me, becomes the son. And then later he becomes king. Okay, so Elah, as a woman, marries Buddha, a man, from the Moon dynasty, and they have a son, Pururava. By the grace of Lord Shiva, Sudyumna received the benediction. Whoops. Elah then became named Sudyumna. So Elah became Sudyumna. That's the same person. Girl, boy. Now Sudyumna, transferred into a woman, marries Buddha. By the grace of Lord Shiva, Sudyumna received the benediction that he would live 1 month as a woman and 1 month as a man. Whoa. Thus he would regain his kingdom, at least for 6 months of the year. Thus he regained his kingdom, and as a man, as the king, he had three sons: Utkala, Gaya, and Vimala. This is Sudyumna's sons as a man, who were all very religious. Thereafter, he entrusted his kingdom to Pururava. That's his son when he was a woman. Pururava became the king. So Pururava is this combination of Sun dynasty, Moon dynasty offspring. And Sudyumna left home and entered into the Vanaprastha order of life. So this is going to be detailed as the chapter progresses. Let's keep going. I'll maybe come back and summarize it one more time, so at least we get the storyline. Text 1 through 8, these first 7 have no purport, so I'll just read the translation. King Pariksit said, having heard the end of chapter 8 about Shraddhadev, the king, Satyavrata, the king, becoming the next Vaivasvata Manu, my lord Shukadev Goswami, you have elaborately described all the periods of the various manus and within those periods the wonderful activities of the Supreme Personality Godhead who has unlimited potency. I am fortunate to have heard all of this from you. So, Chakshusha Manu is the Manu before Vaivasvata Manu. Vaivasvata Manu is the present Manu, Manu number 7 in the cycle of 14. So what he's saying here, text 1, is you've described the previous manus, the first 6, and prominent forms of the Lord that have appeared during those reigns of the 6 manus. I'm fortunate to have heard all of this from you. And now let's hear it about manu number 7. Text 2 and 3. Satyavrata, the saintly king of Dravida Desh who received spiritual knowledge at the end of the last millennium. In this case, millennium means the rule of the previous manu. It can mean different things. Prabhupada uses that term in different ways, at different places. It's Atita Kalpa Ante. Ante means the end. Atita kalpa. Kalpa, in this case, he's saying it's millennium. It's kalpa is a period of time. And here he's applying it because it's appropriate to do so to the previous manu. Thus the previous millennium. Millennium, broad term meaning a long period of time. Previous manu. Satyavrata, the saintly king of Dravida Desh, who received spiritual knowledge at the end of the last millennium by the grace of the Supreme, later became Vaivasvata Manu, the son of Vivasvan. In the next Manvantara, parentheses, period of Manu, I have received this knowledge from you. I also understand that such kings as Ikshvaku were his sons. Vaivasvata Manu's sons. So it's a son of, just as we find in Bhagavad Gita. Vivasvan, Manu, Ikshvaku. So Ikshvaku is one of the sons of Manu, or Vaivasvata Manu. Oh, greatly fortunate, Shukadeva Goswami, oh, great Brahmana, kindly describe to us separately the dynasties and characteristics of all those kings, for we are always eager to hear such topics from you. This is Canto 9. He's nearly finished with his 7 days. He just wants to hear Bhagavatam. Kindly tell us about the abilities of all the celebrated kings born in the dynasty of Vaivasvata Manu, including those who have already passed, those who may appear in the future, and those who exist at present. That's the question that this chapter responds to. Text 6. Sutta Goswami said, when Shukadeva Goswami, the great knower of religious principles, was thus requested by Maharaj Parikshit in the assembly of all the scholars learned in Vedic knowledge, he then proceeded to speak. Text 7. Shukadeva Goswami continued, O King, subduer of your enemies, except the snake bird that's going to finish him. Now hear from me in great detail about the dynasty of Manu. So that's Canto 9. I shall explain as much as possible, although one could not say everything about it, even in hundreds of years. So it's a little summary. Now, this morning's verse on the board. The transcendental supreme person, the supersoul of all living entities who are in different statuses of life, high and low, existed at the end of the millennium, the previous manu, when neither this manifested cosmos nor anything else but him existed. Purport. taking the proper position from which to describe the dynasty of Manu, Shukadev Goswami begins by saying that when the entire world is inundated, only the Supreme Personality of Godhead exists and nothing else. Shukadev Goswami will now describe how the Lord creates other things one after another. So this is Puranic. Purana means history. And within the history, the purpose of history is not just, you know, interesting trivia. The interest of, particularly within the Srimad Bhagavatam, the purpose of history is to illustrate important teachings found within the Vedas or important teachings of life, and then one can understand, oh, that's how it works. This is how the process of creation unfolds from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So there's multiple places, this just being a really short summary of how the Absolute Truth is the source of everything. So there isn't anything that has no connection with the source. There's Krishna and there's Krishna's, and there isn't a third thing. And particularly things that are being selected to speak about is, helping us understand once again that there's one source of everything. And that one source of everything, that's the Absolute Truth, and that Absolute Truth is the Supreme Person. Just like at the first verse, Canto 1, Chapter 1, Text 1, it is said repeatedly that that verse is a mini commentary on Gayatri Mantra. Gayatri Mantra is said to be the mother of the Vedas. And all other mantras come from Mama Mantra, the Gayatri Mantra. The Vedas and all of the other mantras within the Vedas come from Gayatri Mantra. So meditation upon Gayatri, properly done, is very important. We read in the fifth canto, Bhagavatam, that Bharat Maharaj, when he left the kingdom to go to the forest to strive for perfection in bhakti, it was this Gayatri mantra that was his mantra. It was Satya Yuga, so he's engaged in meditation, but his meditation is on Gayatri mantra. And specifically it says in the fifth canto that he was meditating, the object of that meditation, which is the object of Gayatri Mantra, which is the object of the Vedas, which is explained by Srimad Bhagavatam, starting in that first verse, is the Absolute Truth as a person. And ultimately, Krishna's to Bhagavan Swayam. Bhagavatam tells us that in the ultimate stage of realization, the Absolute Truth is Krishna. Krishna in Vrindavan, Swayam Bhagavan Krishna, the Swayam Bhagavan, who is the source of all personalities of Godhead or expansions of Him, etc., etc., etc. The meditation of Gayatri is explained by the Bhagavatam as meditation upon the personality of Godhead. A whole long explanation. Some people think it's meditation on impersonal Brahman, because that's where they're coming from. Some people think it's worship of the sun god, because that's where they're coming from. Some people think other things, because that's where they're coming from. So how do we understand what it is? We understand from Srimad Bhagavatam what it is. It's meditation upon the Supreme Personality Godhead, ultimately Krishna. But the other forms of the Lord, like from the previous canto, Matsya, and then his pure devotee, King Satyaprata, that then becomes Vaivasvata Manu, they're just different manifestations of the unlimited source of everything. But the focus goes not just to the history, who done it to whom thing, but that Krishna is the source of everything. Because around us is part of everything, and that everything that around us comes from the one source. It's meditation on the source of everything. It leads us, this Canto 9 leads us to Canto 10, meditation upon Krishna, so that we can properly understand how the whole picture, starting with creation, and then the forms of Manu that Lord Brahma and the days of Brahma and the cycles of the yugas, it all helps us understand the unlimitedness of the source of everything, who is the Supreme Person, Krishna. Everything connects. We're interested because it connects. We want to see the connection so we don't get distracted. Although it's really easy to get distracted. We want to see the connection of all things with the source, the personality of Godhead, Krishna. So the previous canto is about Matsya and his dear devotee, Satyavrata. Satyavrata becomes the next Manu, and the chapter here begins with Maharaj Pariksit saying, you describe the personality of Godhead, who has appeared in the previous Manus. Can you now describe the next Manu and the forms of the Lord and great kings and so forth that appear during Manu, past, present, and future? And then, you know, in this verse is higher and lower, whatever the positions are, provided it, you know, it helps me, King Pariksit, become more focused on the personality of Godhead, varieties of happiness being fixed upon the personality of Godhead. And we heard at the end of that last canto, just hearing this pastime of Matsya, two things, two benedictions. You go back to Godhead, and all desires are fulfilled. Of course, desires are in relation to the personality of Godhead for one who has that kind of interest in hearing about Matsya Avatar from the proper source, Shukadeva Goswami. So now we're going to hear about other Manu and other features of sons of Manu and so forth and so on. So a prelude is given that the Vaivasvata Manu had 10 sons. He had multiple wives, but one of those was Sangya. And Sangya and Vaivasvata Manu produced 10 sons. Their names are given. One of them is Ikshvaku, and others, 9 others. But before Ikshvaku was born, Vaivasvata Manu, so that the narration goes like this. Vaivasvata Manu wished to have a son. And there was no son, and so he approached Vashishta. And Vashishta is also one of the sons of Lord Brahma, if I'm not mistaken. Vashishta, we hear about Marichi, and from Marichi comes Kashyapa, and from Kashyapa comes Vaivasvata Manu. No, comes Vivaswan. That's mentioned in Canto 6 in detail. So, and Vaivasvata Manu is one of Vivaswan's sons. So Vivaswata Manu wishes to have children, a son, and so he requests Vasishtha to assist him. Vasishtha is very exalted, and Vasishtha is one of these persons that has a incredibly long lifespan. It's called Chiran Jiva. Jiva means living entity, and Chiran means long duration. So his duration of life spans not like an ordinary person. He's present during the beginning of Vaivasvata Manu's reign, before he even has children, and he's the chief priest of Dasarath, and assists Dasarath to have sons. And there's a whole lot of generations in between. So he's old, but he's a Chiranjiva. He has this special benediction from the Supreme Lord to live unbelievably long, or unusually long. There's others that have that capacity. There's a list of them. So Vasishtha assisted, and Vasishtha had some brahmanas who knew Vedic mantras, and Vasishtha was overseeing, and when the wife of Vaivasvata Manu was approached by the brahmana, because during the yajna they're supposed to say certain mantras, they do say certain mantras, and that there is one very important part of any yajna is the intention. The Sanskrit term is sankalpa. So one of the priests that was offering the mantras and the offerings into the fire asked the wife of Vaivasvata Manu, what's the intention?
I want a daughter.
And so when it came mantra time, he, you know, requested a daughter, appropriate mantra for a daughter. And voila, a daughter. And it's not like he was against women, but he was a king that it was his duty. Similar in the case of Dasarath. Dasarath, before Ramchandra was born, had a daughter. It's a long story from Mahabharata. I mean from Ramayana. The daughter... The daughter was given to a dear friend of his, another king from another kingdom. Dasarath was... The kingdom in which Dasarath ruled, Ayodhya, also named Kosala, was built by Manu, according to Ramayana, and the first king to rule there was Ikshvaku, you know, from the Sun dynasty. His son Ikshvaku came to earth and ruled in Ayodhya. And Dasarath was in that line from Ikshvaku, and he had a friend who was from another kingdom called Anga, and that other king, whose name was Romapada, King Romapada, had no children. And so at the king's request, Dasarath said, sure, I'll give you my daughter, and you can take care of her and raise her as your daughter. That was in Treta Yuga. Same thing happens in Mahabharata. In Mahabharata, Kunti's father was Shurasena, a king. And King Shurasena, he didn't name his daughter Kunti, he named his daughter Pritha. And he had a friend, Kunti Bhoja. Kunti Bhoja had no children, so an arrangement was made, you can raise this young girl, Pritha. And so she became known as Kunti, the daughter of Kunti Bhoja. So these things were going on. Kings would sometimes do like this. So Dasarath also had a daughter first, And then he didn't go through this sex change thing. He just, you know, made another arrangement. So kings are, it's part of the duty of a king to have an heir to the throne, which is a male by that culture of the Vedas. There's more details. But so going back to Manu wasn't like sad, oh, it's a daughter instead of a son, but he wanted to have an heir to the throne. So he went back to Vashishta. Help. No problem. I'll approach these two demigods, Mitra and Varuna, and with their sanction, your son Ila can become, this is now the summary at the beginning of the chapter, can become a boy. So the name changed from Ila to Sudyumna. So Sudyumna became the son of Vaivasvata Manu. And as a young prince, along with ministers, was in the forest, heading for Sumeru Mountain. At the foot of Sumeru Mountain was Lord Shiva. Now, over here, Lord Shiva has different residences, just like, you know, important people or wealthy people, they may have different residences. Even Donald Trump has different residences. So, I mean, great personalities can have different residences. And they do. So Lord Shiva, one of those residences was in this forest area at the foot of Mount Sumeru. And Lord Shiva has this arrangement that Parvati and Parvati's associates will not be disturbed by any other man. So anyone that comes into the presence of Lord Shiva gets transformed into a woman, just walking into that Shiva territory. That's what happened. So Sudyumna, who was already started with as a girl, now as a boy, now a young man, becomes, along with his ministers, transformed into women. Sudyumna, a woman. So Sudyumna, a woman, marries Buddha, again spelled differently and a different person, from the Moon Dynasty, and Pururava is born as her son. Poor Sudyumna is supposed to be the ruler of the kingdom of his father, Vaivasvata Manu. So Sudyumna goes to Lord, he performs austerities, and winning the pleasure of Lord Shiva, who by his potency he became a woman, is now given the benediction, well, 1 month this and 1 month that. You can be Sudyumna and rule for alternate months in your father's kingdom. And his father's kingdom, as a king, as a male, he has a queen and three sons. Sudyumna, back and forth, sons, daughters. So the chapter ends, and it'll be discussed in more detail. Sudyumna eventually turns his kingdom over to his son, Pururava, the son from when he's Sudyumna as a woman, married to Buddha, becomes the next king. And Sudyumna at that point takes Vanaprastha. Enough of this back and forth situation. Doesn't say what happens when he goes to the forest, if he's still back and forth, but he leaves the kingdom and Pururava becomes the next king. And we'll hear something about Pururava in the next chapter. So that's repeating the chapter summary at the beginning. Interesting narration. And the chapter begins. Shukadeva Goswami is being asked by Maharaj Parikshit, oh, tell about the kings that are descendants of Vaivasvata Manu. So this is just the very beginning. Oh, king, subduer of your enemies, hear from me in great detail about the dynasty of Manu. That's Manu number 7. Canto 9, primarily, that's the subject matter. There's other information at the end, or the narration. It's too voluminous to say. I'll give some detail, but it'd take hundreds of years to say all the details. So I'm just summary. So now this morning's verse, text 8, is describing what happens at the end of each manu. Now, when we heard about King Satyavrata, if you remember, I'm sure you remember, it wasn't the end of the day of Manu, it was Lord Brahma was taking a nap. And then when he was taking a nap, the demon Hayagriva, not to be confused with the incarnation of the Lord Hayagriva, the demon Hayagriva came and stole the Vedas, and Lord Vishnu annihilated that demon Hayagriva, and so many other things happened. And then this partial inundation subsided, and the rest of the reign of Chakshusha Manu continued. We're not hearing all that detail, but at the end of Chakshusha Manu, there's a or at the end of Manu, there's a partial annihilation. So it's described differently in different places, but here we go. At the end of Brahma's life, there's a total annihilation. We discussed this yesterday. At the end of Brahma's day, there's a partial annihilation. The partial annihilation goes up to and including the heavenly planets and down, down, down all the lower planets. Partial annihilation. And then the next day of Brahma, when he wakes up, he does his sadhana, and then he recreates all of that that was destroyed. Commonly, those are the two that are mentioned. Here, there's an indication of a third. And I don't have verification if it happens at the end of every manu or not. It's not really clear to me, but at least here, at the end of Chakshusha Manu, comes at least a partial annihilation. The language here is this world. Read the purport, text 8. Taking the proper position from which to describe the dynasty of Manu, Shukadeva Goswami begins by saying that when the entire world, at least this earth planet, not entire cosmos or the up to heavenly planets, but when this world is inundated, the flood, only the Supreme Personality Godhead exists and nothing else. Shukadeva Goswami will now describe how the Lord creates other things one after another. So this is not at the end of a day of Brahma, this is the end of a day of, or a reign of Manu, and then there's a change of Manus. So it's, and the statement that nothing else exists doesn't mean the souls go out of existence and then they come back into existence. That's not what it means. And that material nature goes out of existence and then it comes back into existence. That's not what it means. It means the manifest state of those things go out of existence because the souls are eternal and Prakriti is eternal. Correct? The 5 subject matters of Bhagavad Gita, only one of them is not eternal, and that's karma. And the other 4 are eternal. Time, living entities, the personality of Godhead, material nature. They're eternal. They're co-eternal. As eternal as Krishna is, they're co-eternal. So it's not that nothing exists. They eternally exist, but the manifest state of them is withdrawn by the Lord's time potency. And then only the Lord exists. Now, I'll conclude with just making this one other reference and see if there's some discussion. Srimad Bhagavatam has four essential verses that are the essence of all the others. It comes in Canto 2, Chapter 9. Starts with text, I think 29, 30, 31, 32. And so the first of those four says what this verse says. And but it's just like emphatic. Before the cosmic manifestation, I alone exist. The Sanskrit is aham evasam eva great. Before the cosmic manifestation, I alone exist. During the cosmic manifestation, I alone exist. And after cosmic annihilation, I alone exist. Proper understanding of that message is not impersonalism. Proper understanding of that message is there's Krishna and there's Krishnas. And Krishna's energies, the living entities, jivas, prakriti, and time, that's Krishna's. And that's in the category of it's Krishna because it's Krishna's. Yes? Like Om Purnamadak Purnamidam Purnat Purnamadachit. So our understanding of the message of Srimad Bhagavatam is it's the personality of Godhead. Krishna is the source of everything, and the personality of Godhead includes everything that's His. It's the oneness and difference simultaneously message. So that particular verse, Ahamivasam Eva Agre, is the emphasis upon the oneness, not to the exclusion of and simultaneously different. I alone exist. And by the way, aham is first person singular. It's not it, it's I. Not neutral, it's personal. Aham. So Krishna's existence includes everything. That's the Bhagavat understanding. The absolute truth includes everything. And everything is included within Him. So everything is simultaneously one with and different from He who is the source of everything. That's Mahaprabhu's teaching. That's the Bhagavatam teaching. That's our teaching. So back to this verse. During that time of the change of manus, the personality of Godhead alone exists. Means the living entities are in a different status and the prakriti is in a different status and time is not acting as it does during that manifest period where there's karma and activities and the modes of nature moving and so because time energy moves those things. And when time energy is in abeyance, then I alone exist. You can say the same thing. I alone exist during the cosmic manifestation. And then how the Lord unfolds the creation. It's repeated message multiple times, extensively in Cantos 2 and 3, briefly, very briefly here in the beginning of Canto 9, but it's a principle through Puranic narration we're being reminded of. And so the very next verse is going to speak about Brahma appearing from the navel of Garbhadakshay Vishnu's lotus. That doesn't happen at the end of every mano, it's speaking of at the beginning of Brahma's life. And then a series of things happen. Sons of Brahma, starting with Marichi, and then Marichi comes Kashyapa, and Kashyapa comes Vivaswan, and so forth. That lineage coming. So that we know he's making the connection from nothing, from the unmanifest devastation period, inundation period, to manifest, and here comes Vaivasvata Manu. is making that connection clear. Again, it's discussed in Canto 6, the same sequence of personalities. Unfolding of events coming from the source of everything. I think I'll just say one other thing. In the course of my visiting colleges this spring semester, one of the places I visited was University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana. And I met somebody who did his PhD studies in India. He's now a professor in physics. And his wife was previously practicing Krishna consciousness. They got married. Now he's learning about Krishna consciousness as a physics professor. And he likes Krishna consciousness, and he is trying to fit together everything that he knows about physics and everything that he's learning from the Bhagavatam. It, you know, doesn't really fit. Doesn't see how it fits. So he was asking about Big Bang. And from his, you know, he's a professor. He's a PhD in physics. So, you know, you got to know Big Bang. And with all the, you know, sophisticated, calculated information about Big Bang, that people then inductively say, once upon a time, kaboom. And now we have what we have. Instead of once upon a time, what the Bhagavatam says, I alone existed. And then these other things happen. So how does it work? I directed him to the section of the third canto Bhagavatam that discusses this in detail, and mentioned that one time Prabhupada was asked, is there anything in Vedic literature that resembles Big Bang? Prabhupada asked, what's Big Bang? You know, describe it so I can say if there's anything that resembles it. It was described, and Prabhupada said, something like the exhalation of Mahavishnu, where seeds of universes come from his body and they're small and they start to enlarge and expand and expand and expand, expanding universe from, you know, that's the Big Bang. Because where's the Big Bang come from? And they have lots of interesting ideas. One of them is it comes from singularity. What's that? Singularity is dimensionless point of unlimited mass compressed together. Don't ask me where the singularity came from. You can't ask, because that's what he was saying. We're not supposed to ask that. We're trained to don't ask that. You just study the Big Bang, what happens after the Big Bang. So then there was once upon a time a singularity, some time passed, and kaboom. And this unlimited mass went flying all over the place. And the universe is expanding. And his particular question is expanding at an accelerating rate? Is there anything in the Vedas that explains the accelerating rate of expansion within each universe? He said, I don't know. But I can connect you with Rasaraj, or Drutakarma, who may know the answer to that question. And then, latest, this came in just yesterday in our GBC conference, Rasaraj Prabhu, those of you that are new, you don't know him, he's with the Bhaktivedanta Institute, and it's now, he uses the term cutting edge. There's cutting edge, additional, new refutation of Big Bang cosmology based upon, I guess it's theoretical physics or something or other. I didn't read it yet. It's kind of like you have to get your binoculars to, you know, even catch what he's saying. But within the scientific community, there's new empiric evidence that connects with theoretical physics that says Big Bang is hogwash. And I don't know what all of it is. And Vrasaraj's comment is, in this, you know, scientific journal, there's a lot of wrong information, you know, that leads to this conclusion that Big Bang is hogwash. But there's some elements that are interesting and da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, his analysis of... So, as Prabhupada would regularly say, the process of speculation, empirically seeing things and deducing things from what you see, it's ever changing. What you can see and how you interpret what you see, science is, there's no stability to it. It's ever changing. Whereas the Vedas are not based upon sense perception or interpreting sense data. It's just ascending knowledge and it's not changing. Just some interesting, you know, latest about Big Bang cosmology is taking some bullet holes these days. You know, from very prominent persons. It's not new. It's just, it's what scientists do. Someone puts something up and then some other people get on the bandwagon to say yeah, and then some other people say no. Here's some other data and here's how you read the data, and they say no, it's not like that, it's like this. That's how they get their career. What goes on? So while they're doing that, the Bhagavatam is giving us a descending knowledge picture of how things unfold. And we're going to hear some more tomorrow morning's verses about how things unfold from a state of dormancy or inundation to manifesting things by the potency of the personality of Godhead. Okay, it's 8:35. Any comments or questions?
Maharaj, recently we got one information that NASA they invented that the sound vibration from sun is coming like om, like that something. That is how that Bhagavatam is being proved. From each step, like here also another question about Sudumna, how he transformed, means transgender. That's what is happening nowadays, transgenders. See, in Kentucky, recently some law is going on. That is, so we have to believe in Srimad Bhagavatam, that some people, they laugh, oh, how is Sudumna, he is, you know, changing body again, man to woman, woman to man. So this is what is happening in recently in America. And one question, Maharaj. Thing is, you say, now here it is stated, Pururava was born first from...
Sudyumna as a woman of the husband Buddha.
Yeah. And again, he had another three sons, like Utkala and Gaya and another Vimal. So why he gave the dynasty to Pururava, not to...
Why not?
Not to Utkala and
why not? I got about 10% of your question. Is your question, how do we accept the authority of the... On the what basis do we accept the authority of Srimad Bhagavatam? And then... take these stories as fact rather than fancy or mythology? Or are you asking specifically about how Sudyumna, as female Sudyumna, appoints Pururava as the successor when the king is not the female Sudyumna, the king is the male Sudyumna, who has three sons. So why is he accepting Pururava as the successor? Are you asking both things? Just the second one. Just the second one. Okay. Well, he's the firstborn son. So he's appointing the firstborn son as the successor. And we don't have the information in the Bhagavatam as to why not the other ones. We don't know. So the standard is the firstborn son. And it's the same person, whether in this body, or this, you know, female form, male form, it's the same jiva, and he's appointing the firstborn son as the successor. I mean, you can do it differently. I don't know, we don't know. You know, how did the people of the kingdom of Sudumna the man accept as the successor king when Sudumna is a woman, the firstborn son? I don't know. We don't know. And unless Shukadeva Goswami is asked that question by Maharaj Pariksit and he gives the answer, we don't know. It's a part of history, we just don't know. But minimally, the firstborn son becomes the appointed king, successor. Yes?
This seventh Manu, the Manu currently...
What?
Is the seventh Manu, the Manu we're talking about?
Yeah.
The current Manu?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Manu seven is our current Manu. Yes. Back there, Dimitri.
My question is about Big Bang theory. Big Explorer. Big Bang theory.
Big Bang theory. All right.
So, I'm just trying to think logically. When Krishna wants to create universe, he asks Mahavishnu to do that. So probably Mahavishnu creates the Big Bang explosion.
Well,
this is the first act, like.
Yeah, what you're saying is similar to what Prabhupada said. It's not the same, but it's similar to what Prabhupada said. So their theory of Big Bang corresponds with Mahavishnu doing something. Because the Big Bang theory is how the universe comes into being, and Mahavishnu is, from the Vedic perspective, how the universe comes into being. So they certainly there's a connect. They just don't want to acknowledge Mahavishnu. No. Or a spiritual cause. Their perspective is, there's only one thing. There's matter, the laws governing matter, and there's nothing else. Everything can be explained by matter and the laws governing matter, and you don't need God. This other thing is gobbledygook. Matter and the laws governing matter, period. That's our, you know, paradigm. So we're going to explain everything that way. Yes, up front here. Keep it short, okay? You sometimes get like really long. Short.
This is a short question.
Ah, good.
Thank you, Maharaj. Naturally, we will say the Big Bang is illogical, but I remember like 4 years ago at the university, at one club we had, one student asked about the details of Bhagavatam and...
Which of the Bhagavatam?
Some details
of the Bhagavatam.
Specifically pertaining to Mahavishnu and the lotus flower. And, I remember Acharya Nisha remembered this. He explained it, but one student had a problem with it, so they reported us and tried to get our club kicked out. Now sometimes we can't avoid questions where people may voluntarily ask us about details about Bhagavatam. So what are we supposed to do when we say the Big Bang is illogical, but when we hear stories like this from our Mahavishnu, that seems apparently illogical. So what are we supposed to do especially when somebody asks us about details? Should we just say we don't know, or should we try to explain it to them?
Well, if you don't know, you can't try to explain it to them. You can say, I don't know. That's what you do. You know, you can say, just like I did a little while ago. So if you don't know, you just be honest and say you don't know. Now, you can also say, it may very well be that our acharyas have identified passages from scripture that explain this particular information. I haven't come across it. I can try to research it and see if others who have, but you know, have come across it, and I can offer you an explanation or do a little research. Tamal Krishnamurti would do that regularly. Because he would get into details and details, and by doing so invited the audience to get into details. And they would ask some question, and he was very careful. He would not give a speculative answer. He would say, let me research this, I'll get back to you. Like that. You know, I don't know. Let me research it. I'll see if there are some learned persons or somewhere from the writings of our acharyas that offer the explanation to the question that you're asking. I'm not aware of that explanation. I'll do some research and consult others that are well-researched and see if there's an answer to this question. And we should understand there may be multiple answers, or there may not be apparently any answer that we've come across or someone else has come across, and that's okay. Don't fill in the blank with seems to me, perhaps, maybe. Don't do that. Yes?
Maharaj, the passages we're hearing specifically describing the dynasties of the sun god and the moon god.
Yeah.
Do we often, does the Bhagavatam describe other planets that we are familiar with? Does it focus most, I'm thinking there's planets like Jupiter, Venus, which also have lineages, I guess, but does the Bhagavatam focus, it seems more on the sun dynasty and the moon dynasty.
Yes.
As opposed to other.
Yes. Extraterrestrial sources of life.
Is there a reason why sun and moon dynasty are prominent?
Well, the Lord's arrangement. Because the lineages of kings that have ruled are primarily from those two. Now, why? By his arrangement. I mean, it wasn't until I read Ramayana that I came to know. No, the sun god Vivaswan, for some reason, built the city of Ayodhya on earth. I mean, what's the sun god doing building a kingdom on earth? Well, it's an eternal abode of the Lord in his, so it's under the potency or the direction of the personality of Godhead to facilitate the pastimes of Lord Ramachandra and the making manifest that which is an eternal abode, whether there's a kingdom or not, is Ayodhya, or same as like Chaitanya Mahaprabhu requesting Rupa and Sanatan, particularly Rupa, to establish places of Krishna's pastimes when they were lost. So the abode of Vrindavan is eternal, whether there's, you know, the Radhakund that we see today or not. A rice paddy, it's eternal, etc. So by the arrangement of the personality Godhead, Vivaswan did what he did. He manifested. So, and then the lineages of these saintly, you know, divine kings in that dynasty from Vivaswan, because let's remember, Vivaswan is Satyavrata, a perfect person who heard the Vedas from the personality of Godhead. Now why, if Satyavrata heard he's so qualified, he could see the Lord face to face, he heard the Vedas from the Lord directly, and he has to take birth again. Why didn't he go back to Godhead? Because there was some service for him. And so we're hearing about him and his line. So, pastimes of the Lord and his pure devotees. That's the sun dynasty. And what we will hear as we go further into the ninth canto about the moon dynasty. It's not just this marriage with the sun Buddha or the male Buddha in the sun in the moon dynasty. It's, you know, it's there's a bigger piece of information. And these with on earth, these two lineages, the sun and the moon dynasties, are really prominent by the Lord's arrangement, because Krishna appeared in that moon dynasty, that lineage of kings, and Ramchandra appeared in the sun dynasty. Yeah.
I remember in grade school, we had a specific series on Greek mythology.
Greek mythology, yeah.
And coming to the Vedic tradition, I see a lot of, you know, they have Zeus, who's the god of rain and the thunderbolt,
etc., etc.
So
it's just a corruption of Vedic culture. That's what it is.
I was curious, like, the validity of some of those ideas.
It's just corruption of Vedic culture. It's, they didn't, you know, they just corrupted Vedic culture, or Vedic, the Vedas, that the histories of the Vedas, the Devas, and so forth. It's corruption of it. Here's one to support what I just said. Once upon a time, I can't even remember how many years ago, many years ago, I was encouraged to visit South America because, you know, I was available at that time, and they don't get so much visits from others, and so, you know, go visit South America. So I went to visit South America. And in Lima, Peru, I met a husband and wife couple that were working on something like their 7th or their 8th PhD in linguistics. And it wasn't, you know, popular. It was academic. And, they were down-to-earth people. They weren't just this Vata people. They were, you know, they were very clear in their description. Their conclusion, they didn't start with this, but their conclusion is that Sanskrit is the original language from which all other languages come. And they gave examples. So the lore from Greek, when one of their PhDs was in Greek and Latin, and they were, you know, in Spanish and English and French and, you know, so linguistic studies, that the root of all languages is Sanskrit. So it's not a surprise that the Sanskrit literature became Greek mythology. Here's another one. Vedic cult, well, it's pretty simple. Vedic culture, although the Chinese language is different than Sanskrit language, the Vedic culture existed in the Ming Dynasty that ruled for, I don't know, close to 1,000 years, plus or minus. And Vedic culture extended into Russia. There's a number of incidences of excavation of buildings and digging, and they find deities of Vishnu in the earth, and so forth. Read, there's a chapter in Vedic Cosmology and Cosmography by Sataputta. There's a chapter dedicated to the cosmology of the world. All resemble one another. Now, this is Sataputta speaking, but scholars of cosmology say there's three possibilities of how that happened. One, chance, not so likely. Two, our genetic makeup is wired so that we come up with the same cosmology. Not so likely. And a third is the more likely one, but they don't like it, which is there was a culture that was all over the world at one point in time. That's why there's resemblances of cosmology. Greek cosmology is a corruption, adapted corruption of Vedic history, or the Puranic message of, and Itihasa message of the Vedas. A lot of. When Prabhupada, I think I'm going to end with this. I remember one July in our Henry Street Temple in Brooklyn, and Prabhupada was describing Maya. And as he was describing it, I was thinking of Greek mythology, because I learned a little bit of Greek mythology. And he's saying, Maya is beckoning. There's a personality in Greek mythology, I forget her name, Cyrene or something like that. And she's beckoning. Prabhupada said, Maya is beckoning. Come and enjoy me. Come and enjoy me so I can kick you in your face. Etc. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.